Hello, everybody. This is Bhavani, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday on the Progressive Radio Network.
I have a great show planned for all of you today.
My guest will be Brenda Davis. She is a registered dietitian and a leader in her field and internationally acclaimed speaker, and she'll be coming on talking about her most recent book, Kick Diabetes, and I have heard her speak at the Real Truth About Health conference a few months ago, and she was just amazing. So I am really excited to have her on. I'll tell you more about her when she comes on. But first, I want to talk about some things going on in and around the news that you may want to know about and ways that you can take action. First, you know, this week in the New York Times, I always love checking out the science section and the food section. And, you know, they were talking about, once again, getting your nutrients from real foods. And we'll be talking about that with my guest today, Brenda Davis. But it's just so important. So many people eat lousy and then they take supplements and they think they're going to make up for not having a good diet. And, you know, the studies are in and that's just not the facts. You really need to get your nutrients from your foods. And that supplements really are not helpful. As a matter of fact, sometimes they can be harmful. And I shared with everybody on my newsletter that I was informed to take a vitamin D supplement. They said I was low, but nobody said how many milligrams or IU units I was supposed to take. So, of course, you know, I always think more is better. So I have vitamin D 2000 IU pills that I've been taking. And in this article, it says that if you take over 400, you're at a greater risk for cancer. So thank you. I never knew that. So I am going to certainly stop taking the vitamin D. I may take it on occasion, but certainly not more than 400 units a day. So, you know, it's really something to think about. And again, we just need to really question and not just blanketly take what our doctors say as fact. I mean, there's so many issues right now out about vaccines. You know, what's our human rights and our civil rights as parents and as citizens to make our own informed decisions. I don't like the idea of our government stepping in and taking those rights away from us. And I think people need to make their own decisions. There's a lot of money wrapped up in vaccinations. I'm not an expert. I'm not sure. I've been reading both sides because I really want to know. I certainly question the wisdom of piling on so many antibiotics at one time and combining antibiotics. There's no way that the pharmaceutical company or our government tests the combination of these drugs. You know, they might check each one in its own silo by itself and say it's okay. But when you put them all together, what is it doing to our immune system and especially to a baby's immune system? It's something to question. So yes, there's a measles outbreak, but you know, most people don't die from measles. When I was a kid, we all got measles. We all got chickenpox. As a matter of fact, I remember when I got chickenpox, my mother called all her friends so they could bring their kids over so their kids could be exposed to chickenpox and get them when they're little. Because when you're little, you know, it's not life-threatening. It's only when you get older that chickenpox is such a problem. So, you know, I really question the wisdom of vaccinations. One, I will be researching it more and hope to share some of my insights with you when I complete it. But right now, you know, I don't want to go there because there's so many different views on it and I'm not an expert. But it is something that I would say to question and, you know, not just blatantly follow what a doctor tells you because so often they are wrong. And, you know, it's not intentional. You know, they're passing on information that they get, but it's not always accurate. And very often 20 years later, we find out, oops, we made a mistake. We hear that all the time. Science is science, but there's, you know, new science that keeps coming up. So I think it's healthy for us to question things and to not just take things as fact all the time. There was also a great article about eating less meat and how you live longer when you eat less meat. And I'll certainly be talking about that later with Brenda as well. And another thing is, you know, our government and how wrapped up it is with corporate money and how so often the big corporations get a pass. And this was an article I wrote about the Environmental Protection Agency, who just gave a certificate of completion to GE. They, you know, there was a Superfund where they had dumped all this toxic waste up in the Hudson River, and they had to clean it up, and it was costing them billions of dollars, and they have not done a very good job. And yet our government's saying it's good enough, and they just gave them a certificate of completion, even though the EPA admits that the PCB cleanup of the Hudson River has not achieved its goals. It is not to the standards that it was supposed to be, but for some reason they got a pass anyway. So those are the kind of things that just make me so angry. Another one is all these pipelines that are going in all over. You know, New York State, thank you, Governor Cuomo, for making fracking illegal in New York State. But what's the point of having fracking illegal if we're just going to pass all the fracked gas right through our state anyway in these huge pipelines that leak? So right now, our governor has the ability to not give a permit to the Williams company, who wants to build a pipeline that will connect from Pennsylvania through New York, through New Jersey, New York State, and go under the New York Harbor with this fracked gas. And most pipelines do leak. If you look at the statistics on pipelines, they are not safe. They do leak. And to have a pipeline leak, it could take a long time before we even would notice it. It will kill the marine life. It will kill tourism. It will kill plants, and it can kill people. It's just bad, bad, bad. And with the population of Manhattan right there, it's supposed to go right past Staten Island, through New York Harbor, out to Long Beach. It is just a bad idea. And I can't believe it's taking the governor so long to sign off and not give that permit to the Williams company. So there is a big rally actually today. Hopefully the rain will hold off. You're supposed to meet at City Hall Park, which is 15 Center Street, at 5:30. The rally starts at 6, and at 6:30, we're marching across the Brooklyn Bridge. So if you can make it, I know they need your support, and it would be great to see many of you there. I will not be there because I am cooking for Passover Seder, for those that are celebrating Passover. I hope you have a really wonderful Seder with family and friends. And for those celebrating Good Friday and Easter, I also hope you have a wonderful holiday. This past weekend, we had a CSA fair out at the Sisters of St. Brentwood, which is an inspirational estate that's owned by the sisters. And there is a lead sister, her name's Karen Burke, who is just an unbelievable inspiration. She has set up a huge solar project there. I think it's the largest solar project in the state. Solar panels right on the ground that tilt and catch the sun. Wastewater management, rain catchment. They rent over 27 acres to organic farmers to grow vegetables all organically. They have sustainable meat being raised there. It's just an amazing, amazing place. And they do give tours. So if you're interested, that's out in Brentwood, which is not that far. It's only about 45 minutes out from the city, maybe an hour out from the city. Really inspirational. So I recommend everybody checking that out. But what was so wonderful is how many people came out to learn about community-supported agriculture and to sign up with different farms. And I've been talking about this for weeks because as it was approaching, I wanted people to know about it. But it's not too late to sign up for a community-supported program. And what that does is it buys you a weekly share of organic vegetables that are harvested that week. And then you get to cook with them. And very often they're more unusual vegetables. They're not always your typical vegetables that you buy. And so you have an opportunity to explore new tastes. Very often the farms give different recipe cards out, or of course we all have access to the internet to find new ways of using kohlrabi or jicama or something that you might get that you're not so familiar with. Mizuna greens are one of my favorite to grow. They're baby mustard greens, and they are just great in salad and sauteed. And I love those, and most of the farms are growing those as well. So it's really a wonderful way of getting organic vegetables into your house, into your home and family at a really fair, reasonable price. And it's fair for you and it's fair for the farmer because you're cutting out the middle person. Many of the farms also offer add-ons such as beautiful flowers. We had a community supported fishery there where you can get a share of fish delivered. You can get eggs, you can get cheese. There's so many different add-ons. So every farm is different. So that's why it was so great to have them all under one roof so you could really price compare and, you know, compare what each one offers. Some deliver close to your neighborhood. Some you have to go to the farm picking it up. And some people love that because you get to harvest your own vegetables. So, you know, everyone can choose what's right for them. So that's one of the really exciting things. I want to share with all of you this week's recipe. It's a vanilla and almond macaroons. Now, the main ingredient in almond or vanilla macaroons is butter and eggs. So I have been working on a vegan macaroon recipe, and I think I got it. And so I want to share it with you. It really came out great. I'll share the recipe now, and it will get posted on my website so you can get it in time for the holiday this weekend. So you're going to use the juice of 1 can of organic chickpeas. And I love using Eden brand chickpeas just because they use kombu in their chickpeas, which helps with the digestion. So that's the chickpea can of choice that I recommend. But any organic chickpeas will work with as far as the juice. And the juice, it's called aqua fava, and it can beat up just like egg whites. It's quite amazing. So you're going to use the juice from 1 can of chickpeas, 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon water, 1 cup of organic sugar, 1/2 cup of blended coconut oil. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. You know, when you take coconut oil out of the jar, it's very chunky and you don't want to melt it because you want it to still be somewhat of a solid when you use it. So I used an immersion blender just to mix it up so that it was whipped and fluffy. It kind of looked like fluff marshmallows when I added it to the recipe. So that's what I mean, 1/2 cup of blend, but I measured it first and then I blended it up. 3 cups of unsweetened shredded coconut, 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, and 1 teaspoon of almond extract. And in a small bowl, I combine the flaxseed with the apple cider vinegar and water, and I mix that well, and then I set that aside. And in the electric mixer, I beat the chickpea juice until it formed stiff peaks, and it looked just like egg whites. Then I added the sugar, and that made like a meringue. And so, it was really more than tripled in volume, and it all looked white and beautiful like meringue. And then in a separate bowl, using the immersion blender, I blended the coconut oil until it was smooth. I added 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract to that. And then I added the flaxseed mixture to that. Then I added the coconut. And then I folded in the meringue. And that was one of the keys. When I tried it before, I didn't fold in the egg whites. They just kind of, all the air came out of them. So I folded it in to keep some of that air in there. And then I divided the mixture in half. And 1/2 was going to become my almond macaroons and 1/2 was just vanilla macaroons. So I separated them and I added 1 teaspoon of almond extract to the almond ones and 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract to the vanilla ones. And I mixed that up and then I dropped the macaroon mixture onto a sprayed cookie sheet. Now I lined it with parchment paper first and I sprayed it with some coconut oil. And I laid the macaroons there and I used my fingers and just pick up a little blob of it and I put it down and make it look like a giant kiss, kind of, a little peak on the top and just with my fingers. And the edges are what becomes really crispy and delicious, like brittle. And I did that for the vanilla ones and the almond ones. And on the top of the almond ones, so that I know the difference, I put little slivered almonds into the tops of the almond ones. And then I baked it at 325 for about 8 to 10 minutes. Everyone's oven is different. Then lower the heat to 250 and bake for another couple of minutes until they're golden brown. And this recipe makes about 60 macaroons. So, 55 to 60 macaroons. So it makes plenty. And I think I said 3 cups of shredded coconut, but it's actually 4 cups of shredded coconut. I had to add a little more coconut in the final recipe. So that is it. Please make it. Let me know how you like it. I love feedback. And so just a few things I want to tell you about going on in the area that I think you may want to participate in. And then I'm going to invite my guest on, Brenda Williams. So today, like I said, is the rally and march for stopping the pipeline in the city. On April 20th, there's a screening of a film called Dirt, and that's an Earth Day program presented by Gateway Community Gardens, which is out in Huntington. There is the New York Sustainable Energy Conference and Trade Show taking place in Tarrytown. This is a great event for architects and urban planners and environmentalists to find about how you can conserve energy. You know, and it's been inspired by Con Ed, who's saying that, you know, we're not going to, if we don't build another fracked gas facility up in Westchester, that they're not going to be able to supply energy to any new homes. And so this is an opportunity to find out all the alternative ways that we can supply energy to homes without the fracked gas. So that's really a great program. So Grassroots Environmental Education is sponsoring this conference. April 25th, CUNY Urban Food Policy Lecture is having another one of their breakfasts from 9 to 10:30. And the theme is Generation Food, Youth Programming and the Food Justice Movement. So that should be really great. Next weekend, April 27th and 28th, Dr. Maria Michael, who is a spiritual Native American healer and psychologist, she will be doing a workshop in healing circles in the city, and that's worth checking out. All of these are on my website. Also, Friday, April 26th, very important, there's a hearing on the Farm Worker Fair Labor Act, and farm workers and domestic workers have been left out of the fair labor practices, you know, which was passed back in 1938, and farm workers have been trying for decades to get rights like overtime pay and a day off and a sick day. And it's really an important issue. And if you can make it to that hearing, that would be really great. We're looking for support for that. And there's lots more events on my website. So do check out my website. If you have an event coming up that you want me to help share, please just send it to me and I would do my best to post it and share it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Brenda Davis. She is a registered dietitian and a leader in her field. She's an internationally acclaimed speaker and a prolific nutrition and health writer. Brenda's co-authored 11 books with over 750 copies in print in 13 languages. Her most recent book that we'll be talking about is Kick Diabetes. It's an essential diet and lifestyle guide. And she also has a cookbook that goes along with that. Her book, Becoming Vegan, Comprehensive Edition, and Becoming Vegan, the Express Edition, both received star ratings by the American Library Association as the go-to books on plant-based nutrition. And they've won 2 Book of the Year awards in the U.S. and in Canada. Brenda's also co-authored several peer-reviewed journal articles, and she's the lead dietitian for the Diabetes Intervention Project in the Marshall Islands. And we'll talk some more about that during our interview. She's the past chair of the Vegetarian Nutrition and Dietetic Practice Group of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And I first met Brenda at the Truth About Health Conference a couple of months ago and listened to her speak there. And she was just so inspiring. I knew I wanted to get her on my show and introduce her to all of you. So without any further ado, Brenda, are you with me?
I am, Bhavani. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start by just talking about plant-based diet. I know you are an advocate of plant-based diet. Can you share with people listening why eating a plant-based diet is healthier than a diet heavy in meat?
Well, I think the main thing is that when we focus on plant foods, we're focusing on the foods that are most concentrated in the protective components, the components in the diet that help to prevent disease and promote health. And so we're literally minimizing the components that we know to be pathogenic or harmful to health and maximizing those components that are protective. And so we're talking really about things like, for the protective components, things like fiber and phytochemicals and plant enzymes that help to convert some of those phytochemicals into their active forms, antioxidants and anti-inflammatory compounds and the plant sterols and stanols and prebiotics and probiotics and all of these things that really help us to prevent or reduce our risk for disease and also fight disease that currently exists within our bodies. And then, when we think about pathogenic factors, we think about things like, refined carbohydrates, too much of the harmful fats like trans fats and saturated fats, reducing our intake of sodium and NU5GC, which is a pro-inflammatory molecule in meat, and all of the chemical contaminants that tend to move up the food chain, the products of high-temperature cooking like, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and advanced glycation end products and heterocyclic amines and acrylamide and all of these things that form when we expose food to really high temperatures, especially with deep frying and things like that, all the prooxidants, the endotoxins. So when we focus on whole plant foods, unprocessed plant foods, we're really concentrating those protective factors and minimizing those pathogenic factors.
Mm-hmm. So even if someone's eating a plant-based diet, but they're cooking the vegetables at really high heats or grilling them and getting them, charcoaled, or even, the roasting in the oven, where people love the roasting in the oven because it caramelizes so many of the sugars in the vegetables and turns it black. Does that negate the nutritional value of those plant foods?
I wouldn't say it negates the nutritional value. You're still going to be getting the macro and micronutrients from the food, and you'll still be getting some of the phytochemicals and some of the protective components. But if we compare, a roasted vegetable that's caramelized versus a steamed vegetable, there's going to be more of these products of oxidation present in the roasted vegetable. And it's not that you should never have roasted vegetables. I think it's really important for us to balance our enjoyment of food and traditional preparation methods and all of those things with, sort of the health outcomes. And so what I recommend people do is to use the sort of moist cooking methods most of the time. So you're making soups and stews and steaming and water sautéing and so forth most of the time. And then for the special occasions, you can, enjoy the foods baked and so forth. In terms of especially if you have disease and you're trying to reverse disease, you really want to minimize the products of oxidation. And so one of the things that I often suggest or tell people is when you have diabetes or heart disease or cancer or some sort of serious diagnosis, the food that you eat can serve as gasoline on the fire or water that puts out the fire. And you really don't want to be putting gasoline on the fire. So we want to minimize all of those potentially toxic compounds. And that's it in a nutshell, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So many people, question vegan diets, especially for infants and children. But many people that have raised their children completely vegan and their children are very healthy. So can you share with us, kind of debunking some of those myths and fears that people have?
Yeah, so what we actually know is that people that are serving their children or providing their children with a well-planned or appropriately planned plant-based diet, we know it can be healthful, nutritionally adequate, and we know that it may also provide benefits long-term in terms of disease prevention. Now, one of the things that is important, we also know that children who are eating plant-based diets tend to consume more fruits and vegetables, consume fewer sweets and salty snacks, have lower intakes of saturated fat, have reduced risk of overweight and obesity, and tend to have better lifelong eating habits. So those are all really good things. But we also have to recognize that there are some potential pitfalls. And so parents who are overzealous about restricting fat, restricting certain foods where you're not paying attention to sources of vitamin B12, for example, these are potential pitfalls that can have serious consequences. And so it's really important that the diet is appropriately planned and that people are following some sort of guidelines. And that's why I've written the books I've written, like Becoming Vegan, because we want people who choose to eat plant-based to get it right. Because every right. time that, you see someone fail on a plant-based diet, it really becomes exhibit number one for why people are justified eating meat and animal products. And so we really want to avoid any potential pitfalls, period.
Mm-hmm. That's why, I really love the difference between a plant-based diet versus just a vegan diet, because I know for many people who become vegans, their diet is completely not healthy. They're fine eating donuts if it doesn't have any animal product in it. They're fine eating artificially colored, black forest cherry cake or with sprinkles on it, It's not about, exactly. It's just about not eating animal product, and it's not about a healthful diet. I remember when I first became vegetarian, and this wasn't vegan because, back then I didn't know any problem with cheese or anything. So I was just vegetarian. But basically I just cut out animal products. I cut out meat, and not dairy. I still wasn't eating dairy, but I didn't know. I basically said I was on a white diet, I ate bagels, yeah. I ate potatoes, I ate pasta, and that certainly wasn't healthy.
And what people need to understand is that when you switch from a diet that's high in saturated fat and meat and so forth to a diet that's high in refined carbohydrates, sort of the pasta and bagel diet, there are no health advantages. It's a wash. I mean, you're trading off one group of unhealthy foods for another group of unhealthy foods. And so you're right that within that sort of whole realm of vegan diet, we want to be moving towards a whole food, plant-based vegan diet. That's really critical, especially for people who are at high risk for disease or who already have a chronic disease. You're not going to get the kind of results that you might be hoping for on a diet that's high in refined carbohydrates.
Right. Now, you touched on B12, and I think people hear about that all the time, that as a vegan or even just a plant-based eater, that you are at risk of a B12 deficiency. I know, vegans that go in and get, a B12 infusion, what is it? Intravenous B12. Anyway, and that just doesn't seem really healthy to me. So can you talk a little bit about B12 deficiency, and are plant-based eaters at risk for that?
Oh, absolutely, because vitamin B12 is really not present in most plant foods. You may get a tiny bit in a fermented food. You may get a little bit in mushrooms that have been grown on manure. You may get a little bit, but generally not enough. And so B12, you find, is more concentrated in animal products. And so when we're removing animal products, we really need to make sure we have a source of B12 in the diet. And this doesn't just go for vegetarians. It also goes for anyone over 50. And the Institute of Medicine actually recommends that people over 50 do not rely on animal products as their main source of B12. They need to rely on the same foods vegans do, which are fortified foods, or supplements, and that's it. And so and a lot of people say, well, doesn't that prove that being vegan isn't natural? Well, we eat very differently than we did when we were hunting and gathering, or just gathering even, because when you pull food out of the ground and you eat it as is, There may be some B12 there. There's B12 in the water. There's B12 everywhere in nature. But we, because of the way we grow food now, and we're, you know, irrigating it with water that may come from a source that's near an animal feeding operation where it could be contaminated with pathogenic bacteria. We have to make sure our food is clean so that we're, you know, so we eliminate any B12 producing bacteria generally and all other potentially pathogenic bacteria as well. And so plant foods, we really should not be relying on them. Even some people think, you know, seaweed is a good source, for example, of B12, and it can have B12, but when we, you know, it can also have inactive non-cobalamin cornoids that look like B12. They attach even to B12 receptor sites, but they're not B12. And they can even contribute to a functional B12 deficiency because they don't let real B12 on the receptor sites. So it's just, you know, when we dry seaweed, we convert some of the active B12 into inactive analogs. And so we just need to be very aware that it's probably not, we're not at a stage yet where we can rely on seaweed as our primary source of B12. So even organic vegetables, you know, fermented foods, none of those things should be relied on as our primary source of B12. We need to be using either fortified foods like, you know, nutritional yeast that's got B12 in it, some doesn't, or the fortified non-dairy milks, meat analogs, those cereals and so forth that are fortified, and or a B12 supplement. And even if you use some fortified foods, it's probably a good idea to take a B12 supplement once or twice a week just to make sure that you are where you are with vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bonnie, I want to say, too, just while we're on the topic of B12, that one of the very first signs of B12 deficiency is numbness and tingling in your extremities. You tend to get anemia, this megaloblastic anemia. You can get nerve damage, those kinds of things. But first, you get this numbness and tingling in the extremities of your fingers and toes, and even the tip of your nose sometimes. And if you're feeling those kinds of symptoms, you need to make sure you're getting some B12 in your diet, and maybe you want to get your B12 tested and consider taking supplements.
Mm-hmm. And what if someone was eating an animal product? What animal product has the highest B12 or the best source of B12?
Well, you know, in animal products, you get about 2 or 3 micrograms in a 3-ounce serving of meat, or poultry or fish or whatever. You get about 0.5 microgram in an egg. You get almost 1 microgram in a cup of milk. So just to give you an idea, there's nothing that's, you know, got huge, huge amounts. What we need, or what the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, says we need, is about 2.4 micrograms a day. But that's actually probably not enough to minimize the rise in homocysteine, which can increase our risk of heart disease. So what we're looking for probably is closer to, you know, 5 to 10 micrograms. But if you're taking a supplement, you need a lot more, because you only absorb, if you're taking a supplement of 1,000 micrograms, for example, you might absorb 0.5 to 1% of it. So you're absorbing just a tiny amount. If you're taking a sort of a once-a-day supplement, like even a multivitamin or something, then you're probably looking for at least 25 micrograms in that supplement. If you're getting it from fortified foods, I would say you want to be eating about 3 servings a day with at least 2 micrograms per serving to make sure that you really are where you need to be. And the DV is 6 micrograms, so that means you want 100% of the DV.
Mm-hmm.
Or the daily value, yeah.
Yeah, because you heard at the beginning of my article, you know, or my talk, you know, I had read this article about supplements, and of course, you know, how it's much better to get your nutrients from real foods as opposed to supplements. And, you know, I'm just wondering, is it better, you know, for someone to take a supplement for the B12, or would you recommend someone, you know, twice a week having a piece of fish to get that B12?
No, I would say that, you know, definitely if you want to be vegan, be vegan for many mm-hmm. reasons, for animals, for the environment, but just make sure you're getting a source. And it's not, you know, there's nothing different about the B12 from a supplement versus from a whole food. and or from a fortified food. In fact, B12 from a fortified food, where you're adding B12 to the food, is actually more reliable in terms of B12, you know, status than is B12 from an animal food, because the B12 from an animal food is bound to protein. If you're over the age of 50, your ability to cleave that B12 off the protein it's bound to diminishes quite significantly. So it's estimated 10 to 30% of people over 50 can't cleave the B12 off the protein it's bound to. However, if you're consuming, you know, cashew or almond milk with B12 added, you have no problem getting the B12 from that food. So
So where do they add the B12 from? What's the source?
The B12 comes from B12 producing bacteria.
Ah.
And so it's, you know, it's fine. I mean, and nutritional yeast is a great source for vegetarians, because it's not only a source of B12. If it's, you have to make sure it's grown on a B12 medium, like Red Star Vegetarian Support Formula, for example. But make sure it's got the B12 there, because some nutritional yeast doesn't. But the stuff that does, and a lot of it does, it's also an amazing source of other B vitamins as well.
Mm-hmm. And also is a great source of, great for taste and for recipes. I mean, I use it a lot in my cooking.
Yeah, it's got a kind of a cheesy flavor.
yeah, it's wonderful. I actually went to a vegan restaurant and they had a fondue that was made out of kohlrabi and nutritional yeast that was unbelievable. It's really great. Anyway, let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to also talk about some of the other issues that people are concerned about, you know, whether it's the omega-3s or the calcium. You can shed some light on that. But everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Brenda Davis, and we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information. The kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one Progressive Radio Network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis. And there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right? Thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and Ayit Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Brenda Davis, a registered dietitian and internationally acclaimed speaker about plant-based eating. So Brenda, right before the break, I wanted to touch on calcium. I know calcium, you know, is an issue that many people are concerned about. I know, There's more calcium in dark leafy green vegetables than in a lot of dairy, but can you shed some light on that for my listeners?
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, I think most of us were raised believing that we have to have cow's milk to get enough calcium, and that was taught in grade school. It's in the media, it's in advertising, and so forth. And it's true, cow's milk has a lot of calcium. It has about 300 milligrams of calcium per cup. It doesn't mean it's an essential food. When we look at the milk of other mammals, like moose and deer, for example, probably has about twice that amount of calcium per cup. It doesn't make that an essential food either. If we look at pre-agricultural populations, humans actually average probably between 1 and 2,000 milligrams of calcium per day in their diet without a single drop of cow's milk. So the best sources of calcium are actually what we would call low oxalate greens. So that means greens that don't have a lot of oxalic acid, like kale, broccoli, turnip greens, and Chinese greens. And these greens, the absorption of calcium from cow's milk is about 32 to 34%. The absorption of calcium from dark greens that are low in oxalate ranges from about 40 to 63 or 64%. So the greens that we can't really rely on as great sources of calcium are greens that are high in oxalates, like spinach, beet greens, Swiss chard. So they have a lot of calcium in them, but the calcium is bound up with oxalates, so they just kind of go through us. We get maybe 5% of the calcium from those foods. Now, other calcium-rich plant foods are tofu that's made with calcium, can be a really rich source of calcium. Non-dairy milks that are fortified with calcium, so all the almond and cashew and soy and so forth milks. Legumes are a relatively good source of calcium. We absorb probably 20 to 25% of the calcium that's in them. And then some nuts and seeds like almonds and sesame seeds, chia seeds, are good, and hemp seeds, especially with the shell, are good sources of calcium. Blackstrap molasses, figs, even oranges have like 60 milligrams of calcium per orange. And what's really interesting is if you look at, you know, becoming vegan and not eating the meat and the fish and eggs and so forth, those foods aren't very rich in calcium. All of the foods in the plant-based kingdom have some calcium. If you add it up, and especially if you include at least one serving of calcium-fortified non-dairy milk, it's not that difficult to get to the, you know, 1,000 or 1,200 or 1,300 milligrams a day that's recommended. But we do need to be aware of where the calcium is and be sure to include sources in our diet. And so, for example, if you're having a salad with spinach in it, you want to make sure you have a lot of greens that are also high calcium greens, like kale and other greens.
Mm-hmm. And what about the omega-3 fatty acids that people say you have to eat fish to get? What do you recommend for that?
You know, fish does have, especially cold water fish, has a lot of these long-chain omega-3s called EPA and DHA. And some plants have a lot of omega-3s as well, but they're the less biologically active ALA. So flax seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, walnuts are all relatively good sources of ALA, but they're less biologically active. And the body does have an ability to convert that ALA into EPA and DHA, but the conversion is pretty slow and can be very limited, especially in people with diseases like diabetes or hypertension. But what people need to understand is fish don't actually make EPA and DHA. EPA and DHA are actually made by plants called microalgae that are in the ocean or the sea or whatever. And microalgae is the source of EPA and DHA for fish as well. And it sort of moves up the food chain and ends up in the fish. And so we can actually culture this microalgae and take it in supplement form or add it to foods and get it directly from the source rather than eating fish to get it. So that's an option for people eating plant-based. And macroalgae, or the big, you know, seaweed, also contain a little bit of EPA, but you'd have to eat a lot of it for it to be a significant source. And, you know, the one thing about going with the microalgae as a source is you're not getting a lot of the contaminants because you're growing, you're culturing it. So you're not getting the, the mercury and the dioxins and so forth that are, you know, potentially present in the fish. So that, mm-hmm. and it's sustainable, it's cruelty-free. You're getting it by, you know, growing microalgae.
And how much do you recommend people taking? Because like you heard my thing with the vitamin D, I was not advised to how much to take. And I, you know, got a supplement that was higher. I got 2,000 units for vitamin D. And this article said you shouldn't have more than 400 a day.
Well, that article is greatly contested by a lot of other articles. To me, what you need to do is you need to have your levels tested. If your levels are dismally low and you're vitamin D deficient, you may need to take 2,000. If your levels mm-hmm. are good during the winter, to keep them good, you may only need 400. So it really just depends on what your vitamin D status is. And that's, I think, worth testing, because I've had a number of friends who have had reasonable sun exposure, have their levels tested, and find out that they were fairly profoundly vitamin D deficient. And so they would need to add more than what someone who had reasonable vitamin D status would need to add. So I think that's important to know, whether we're talking about iron or vitamin D or whatever nutrient we're talking about. It's good to know where you're at so that you know what an appropriate level of supplementation would have to be if you need to supplement, if you're deficient. Some people don't need to supplement at all because their levels are really good. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And so back to the omega-3s, how much do we need? It's wonderful if you can get your omega-3 fatty acid levels tested, and you can do that. If you know, then you would know where you should be supplementing. But for the average person, if you were eating fish a couple times a week, maybe 2-3 times a week, you'd be averaging probably about 200 or 300 milligrams of EPA and DHA a day. And so that seems to me a kind of a reasonable number to go for. And that's actually the amount you would get in a lot of these supplements. Some supplements are higher, and if your status is low, then you'd want to go a little higher. And I've known several people who have been low, have supplemented and found 200 to 300 just wasn't enough to get their levels where they needed to be. So they had to go to 700 or 800, sometimes even 1,000 milligrams a day to get them where they wanted to be. And once you get them to where they need to be, you can probably fall back to 200 or 300 milligrams a day.
Wow. Okay. And I would like to just change a little bit. I know you do a lot of work in the Marshall Islands.
Right.
And there seems to be a really high rate of diabetes there. Can you first share where the Marshall Islands are? I know they're in the Pacific, somewhere near Australia, I believe.
But, well, they're actually about halfway between Hawaii and Australia, in the middle of the Pacific, about 7 degrees north of the equator. And there's just nothing anywhere around them, nothing within a couple thousand miles of any direction. So they're about 3,500 miles directly north of New Zealand. And so, very, very remote. And they have among the highest rates of diabetes in the world. Well, it's interesting when you look at populations who have lived off the land for many generations, whether it's our Aboriginal populations or whether it's the Pacific Island populations. When people live off the land, their bodies tend to be pretty metabolically efficient. So they need to, they traditionally have worked really hard to get their food. So in the Marshall Islands, they spearfished and they climbed coconut trees, and they were very physically active, very lean. They ate absolutely zero processed foods, and they lived on plants and fish, and that was pretty much it. And then all of a sudden, they start living on these imported processed foods. And in the Marshall Islands, people eat white rice, white sticky rice with spam or some sort of barbecued meat on top, and they wash it down with luau, which is, high fructose corn syrup drink. And for snacks, the children's favorite snack is ramen noodles, which are those dry, fried, salty noodles with Kool-Aid powder sprinkled on top for flavoring. it just doesn't get any worse than that. So you take a population that for so many generations ate off the land, and all of a sudden you start feeding them these hyper-palatable, hyper-caloric diets. They get diabetes rapidly because their bodies are not designed to withstand that kind of food. And so it's the same with our First Nations or our, you know, Aboriginal populations. They develop diabetes faster than the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I would think that they still, you know, we're free of getting all those processed foods, but they're importing all those foods in there, huh?
Yeah, and the reason they're doing that is you know, they're the main island there called Majuro, that might sustain, I don't know, 500 people. There are 30,000 people there now. There's no way the island can produce enough food for that population. So they have to import food. And they are poor. There's not a lot of, jobs for people. And so they import the cheapest food available, which is things like white rice and ramen noodles and cheap sugar drinks. And so that's why they have, you know, I think the last estimate was somewhere close to 37% of the adult population was diabetic. And those who aren't diabetic, most are pre-diabetic. And so it's a very sad situation because here was a population where the people were so healthy, they had no diabetes, none, zero. You know, 80, 90 years ago, there was none. And now they have the highest rates in the world. And the number one surgery on the island is amputations due to diabetes. It's a tragedy. And these islands have almost no elevation. They're the first islands that will go because of global warming. So the people will be displaced and end up having to move to the States or, you know, to Hawaii, wherever they can move. And there is a compact with, there's an agreement with the United States government, and they do have easy access to becoming a U.S. citizen, even though the Marshall Islands are not owned by, they are an independent country, but they were used as atomic bomb testing grounds by the United States after the Second World War. And so there's, a lot of support from the United States because of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your work, you've used plant-based diets to help people reverse diseases like heart disease and diabetes. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you have been able to guide people to better health?
Absolutely. And so in the Marshall Islands, we actually did a research study where we took five cohorts, five groups of Marshallese people, and we even had control groups and the whole bit doing the usual care. And we saw, you know, incredible changes in their health. In fact, so quickly I was shocked. Within a week or two, we had to take away all their medications in most cases, to be honest. Their pain in their legs would disappear, their constipation would disappear, their heads would clear, they'd be able to walk when they couldn't, you know, hardly walk before. And so we saw just remarkable changes. Simply, what people need to understand is that every single cell of your body is a product of what you put in your mouth. There's no doctor or dietitian that can eat or exercise for you. You know, you are in control of that. And when we provided these people with really healthy foods and with, you know, with exercise program and walking after meals and all of these things, your body wants to heal itself. And it is remarkable how fast that starts to happen. They were stunned. And in many cases, we saw complete reversal of their diabetes. So that was remarkable. And people say, well, can that work at home? Can we reverse diabetes and heart disease at home? And I would say if we can do it in the Marshall Islands, where they have no money, they have no access to gyms, they have very little produce and it's very expensive, we have no excuses here. We have everything by comparison. And so for us, it's just so much easier than it is for them. And I'll share a little story with you about a family that I love to share this story because I love what happened to this family. a young man came to me, 36 years of age, with cancer. And I was speaking at a conference, and he came up to me after the conference and said, I have cancer, and I want to do whatever I can do to increase my chances of survival. Can you help me? And so I, along with Michael Clapper and some other in the plant-based, other folks in the plant-based world, supported him in becoming completely plant-based, 100%. And what happened was his entire family said, whatever diet you're doing, we're doing with you. His parents, his brother, his wife, the whole family. And I love that. It doesn't happen very often, but they wanted to be able to eat as a family. And what happened to, the fellow that had cancer was his cancer went into remission. But what happened to his father was probably even more remarkable, because his father had type 2 diabetes for about 20 years. He had just had a major heart attack. He had uncontrollable hypertension, high cholesterol, peripheral artery disease. He was going into renal failure. He had recurring gout. He had cataracts. He was just a mess. And his physician said he would probably live about 2 years. He was being treated on 17 pills a day and 35 to 40 units of insulin. Within fairly short order, less than a year, he was on zero insulin and zero pills. And his numbers, it was unbelievable. His fasting glucose was completely normalized to about 80 to 87 milligrams per deciliter. His A1C 5.1. His blood pressure 115 over 70. They didn't see anywhere close to that on two or three medications. They did PET scans. His arteries opened up. His heart function returned to normal. He had normal ejection fraction, normal chamber size. When before he had severe coronary artery disease, his peripheral artery disease disappeared. His kidney function normalized. They were thinking he'd need to start dialysis. He didn't need any of that. No further recurrence of gout. His cataract stopped growing. He didn't require surgery after that. And 7 years later, he's still free of all these diseases and these medications. And so this is really what is possible. A fairly radical diet. They were doing a fairly high raw, 100% whole food, plant-based, they weren't putting any gasoline on the fire. But
amazing. And we're just about out of time. So I just really, before we run out of time, can you share with my listeners how they can get in touch with you if they have questions?
My email address is Brenda Davis, all one word, at telus.net, or they can go on to my website, and my website is brendadavisrd.com.
Wonderful. And I'll share that on my website too, if you didn't have a pen and write that down. And Brenda, thank you so much for joining us, and your wealth of information is just really inspiring. So thank you. And to all my listeners out there, thank you for joining us. Have a great rest of the weekend. Happy holidays, whatever you decide to celebrate. Earth Day's coming up, so let's celebrate the Earth. Good health to you all, and see you all again next week.